This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, Tennessee, has become an iconic home for American country music, known best for its shows in the round, where writers and performers take turns playing and telling stories. This style of performance inspired an ongoing collaboration between beloved North Carolina writers Lee Smith and Jill McCorkle and Nashville musicians Matresha Berg and Marshall Chapman. The four collaborated to create the 2010 musical Good Old Girls and now continue their artistic partnership for an occasional fundraising performance around the area. The four will be on stage together this Sunday at 6 o'clock at Leland Little Auctions in Hillsboro, and they're trying to raise some money to help restore the Burwell School. First, three of them join us for a preview. Lee Smith, an award-winning writer whose most recent book is a memoir, Dime Store. Lee Smith, so good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. I love to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you, along with Jill McCorkle, the author of the 2013 novel Life After Life. Life After Life, and has served as a visiting writer for at least the last semester at UNC Wilmington. Jill, welcome back. Good to have you as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And joining us by phone from Nashville is musician Marshall Chapman, behind 13 critically acclaimed albums. Marshall, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thanks. Am I back?
You are, yes. Nobody on my staff now remembers this, but it was back when we were in Chapel Hill, and you had, the show was coming out of there, and Lee, you had, we'd done a collaboration, and yeah, we met.
So I have been there.
You have.
The return.
In fact, you're actually not here now. That's the odd thing. So if there's a lie in what I said,
well,
it's that you're not really here.
Due to the miracles of technology.
It's great. Lee, talk a bit about the way this collaboration looks now and how it mirrors the kind of in-the-round evenings at the Bluebird Cafe.
Well, I think Marshall is really the one that got this whole thing going, because, you know, forever they have had at the Bluebird Cafe songwriters in the round. And then during the Southern Festival of Books, Marshall got the idea of bringing in writers. And it was so much fun and just so interesting to see people play off of each other with their different genres and so on. And so then we've known each other since the early 70s. And at a certain point, one of Marshall's friends, Matresha Berg, wrote a song named Good Old Girls. And she called up Marshall and said, well, hey, let's make a musical. And so I pulled in Jill. And we just started having so much fun. And then Paul Ferguson took a lot of our work and shaped it into the actual play, which is still going around the country. But we like to just get together now and do a few old songs, a bunch of new songs, new narratives, and so on. And, there's nothing more fun and more creative than bouncing, you know, spoken word and music off of each other.
Marshall, you're about to say something, right?
Oh, I'm always about to say something.
Well, tell us why you thought this would be a good idea. Because, you know, Lee just said, look, there's nothing more fun than bouncing spoken word off of music. But I guess if you're a musician, that is a bit of a leap. You're up there, you're on stage, you're creating this vibe, and then the music stops and somebody starts, you know, reading their book. What made you, and it does work out, but what made you know that this would be such a good idea?
Oh, I never know if anything's going to be a good idea. I just know when I've had a good time, and every time we get together, that's what happens. I mean, I'd have to be smart to do that. The show itself is like actresses in a band, and they have a script, and they know what they're doing. When we get together, we have no idea what we're going to do, but something always happens, and if people want to know what going to happen, they'll just have to come.
That's right.
Well, and this collaboration and just having fun, I mean, you were off Broadway with Good Old Girls, so I mean, the idea of just having fun and not knowing what you're doing has quite a payoff, at least when you all get together and do it. Jill, you pulled into this collaboration in many ways. You were pulled, I think, because of the contemporary women in your work, and you say that's even gotten stronger, your sense of the contemporary woman as characters in your book.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of my women match up with a lot of Marshall's songs, so we go back and forth. And I think if I strike a certain chord in the show, that's the one that I go to.
Tell us a bit about your story, Midnight Clear.
Well, this is a story about a woman who is just recently divorced, so starting life on her own with young kids, sort of facing the holidays and all these things traditionally family-oriented and having to look at it from a new way.
Will you read for us?
Sure.
Oh, good.
What makes this night different from all the rest? Charles asks. His hair is damp with sleep as he follows me from room to room, a crumbling graham cracker in one sticky hand and a glass of chocolate milk in the other. He's 5. His brother Michael, who's 8, is absorbed in the Game Boy he holds in his hand, a series of beeps and distracting sounds. He's also watching cartoons and moving one bare foot under the edge of the rug in a way that flips it and scatters dust and crumbs about every 30 seconds. The other question Charles has asked 10 times since waking from his nap is how Santa Claus comes out of a wood-burning stove. Won't that hurt, he asks. What if he wants to bring something big? This one got his brother's attention. He's figured everything out about Santa Claus. You can see it in his eyes, but is not yet ready to admit the truth. Once the truth is admitted, there's no taking it back, no return to what you once believed in so completely. You would think that those early experiences of disappointment and loss and disillusionment would prepare us for what lies ahead. Things like career disappointments, a parent dying too young, a marriage that functions the way a mirage does, constantly forcing physical distance so you can continue to see something that isn't really there. It's Christmas Eve, our first in this new house, our first in our new family configuration. A single mother and 2 young sons. Charles has already taken the little figure of Joseph out of the crash several times and placed him at the far end of the table with a green matchbox car that resembles the one his dad drives. You live over here now, I've heard him say, and then nod and giggle as if the little plastic Joseph had just told him a joke. You're still my daddy, he says, a recital of all he has heard during the past 11 months. He's claimed the Jesus figure as his own namesake and a little plastic Spider-Man figure as his brother. I, of course, am Mary and keep finding my figure placed outside of the manger, close enough to see what's going on but out of the building nonetheless. You're working in the yard, he's told me. You're at the grocery store and we'll be right back.
Writer Jill McCorkle reading an excerpt from the story Midnight Clear. She's going to be on stage with fellow writer Lee Smith and musicians Marshall Chapman and Matresa Berg for a fundraising performance at Leland Little Auctions in Hillsboro. Marshall, your songs often follow Jill's readings. Tell us a bit about some of the parallels in your style or whether you think they need to be parallel when you follow a poignant and beautiful selection like that.
Oh, God, I don't know how to do this. How my songs follow Jill's? Well, I don't know, Jill. What do you think?
Well, I mean, seriously, take us through the process because you've heard that. That was a beautiful piece.
You're making me think.
Well, yes. Yes. This is the Thinking Person show.
Know, we are,
but it's only for another 10 minutes.
Well, hey, Marshall, talk about goodbye, little rock and roller. That's
y'all
a good matchup.
We're an hour earlier here in Nashville, Tennessee.
I see.
Just want to remind your listeners.
All right.
Goodbye, little rock and roller.
I can't even make a fist. What?
Goodbye, little. Yeah.
What does that follow, Jill?
Well, talk about that song because I think there's so much in it.
I wrote Goodbye, Little Rock and Roller one weekend and finished it on a Mother's Day. I had started writing it on an airplane that had just taken off from Los Angeles. And, I was really tired, and I've been in Los Angeles for a week not getting enough sleep, and I couldn't wait to just, you know, fall asleep on the plane, which is my favorite place to sleep. And I've often said that when you have a good idea or a song, I've likened it unto a mother being 10 centimeters dilated with a child. You're not going to take a nap at that point. That Nicky Vicky is going to come out into the world, and there's nothing you do about it. And that's what happened on that plane. I started writing. I kept asking them for American Airlines cocktail napkins back before they had all those websites covering it all up where you could actually write on it. And just had about 10 in my pocket when I got home. I just kept writing. It's a long song. It's got 6 verses. I usually write just 3 verses. Mm-hmm. And it kind of comes full full circle of woman leaving home, and then she has a child.
There you go.
You did it.
You
did
it.
You did it. Okay. So what we're going to do, Jill, is you're
going to,
Jill is going to take over the show starting Monday, folks. So this will be my last show. Jill McCorkle will start because you know how to ask the questions. Hey, Marshall, let me ask you to talk about another song for us that you wrote, and this would be the title cut off of your 2013 album, Blaze of Glory. We're about to play a little clip, but maybe you can set that one up.
Oh, cool. Well, God, I'm sitting at the table right now that I wrote that song. I was married at the time, and my husband is a great cook, and he had fixed dinner. And I just happened to have a little tape recorder on my table, and I just started singing into it. I never intended to make it this far. I never had a fallback plan. And I went, oh, holy shit, that's something. And then all of a sudden, dinner was on the table. But, you know, it was like, I was 10 centimeters dilated. It was like, bam, that song just showed the head in the first line, and I had no choice. But it was about 3 weeks later before I could get back to it. And when I did, you know, it's sometimes, Jill, Lee, I know y'all had it. Don't you hate it when you start writing something and the bar is already raised high?
And
you think, well, God, the only way I can go is down. But I just was patient, which I've heard some writers say that's the only thing you have to know to be a writer is patience. And I was patient, and I wrote this bridge that was, okay, so this is about, you know, I always thought I'd go in a blaze of glory. You know, I had that line, and I knew that was the title. But when I wrote the first bridge, I wrote about Janis Joplin and all these people that died in a blaze of glory. And then when I sang it didn't feel right. It sounded like I was comparing myself to them, and I didn't want to do that. So I went for a walk. And when I came back, that image of seeing Elvis Presley at age 7 from a colored balcony back during, you know, segregation, it just poured out. You know, I saw Elvis Presley back in 1950. The world was different then. Everything was fixed. When he walked out on stage, it shook us to the core, and that colored balcony came crashing to the floor, and it was like, holy shit. I hope I can say that on your show.
Well, actually, Marshall, I would ask you, in the spirit of the holidays, if you feel emotional again, how about O Holy Night?
Well,
a little holiday,
right,
a little holiday thing.
It feels as good coming out of the mouth, to tell you the truth, but I'll do my best.
Okay, well, I tell you what, while you get that all worked out, we will play a clip from
Blaze of Glory. Holy Jesus. I like that.
I never intended to make it this far. I never had a fallback plan. I always thought I'd go in a blaze of glory, a blaze of glory. Like a comet across the night sky, playing rock and roll music with my hair on fire. Every show was a blaze of glory, a blaze of glory.
Has a little clip of Blaze of Glory by singer-songwriter Marshall Chapman. She's going to be on stage this Sunday with fellow musicians Matresa Berg and writers Lee Smith and Jill McCorkle for a fundraising performance at Leland Little Auctions in Hillsboro. We've got the details at our website. You know, I'm glad you gave us the backstory to that song, because honestly, when I heard the lyrics, the first line, I never intended to make it this far, never had a backup plan, I thought it was the Donald Trump campaign song.
Well, it could be. It's funny. Yeah, I mean, I heard the first half of your show, and it's all about Donald Trump. I think we should add that our show is going to be a Donald Trump safe zone, where we're not going to talk. Let's don't talk about him.
Well,
I mean, I'm tired. I mean, whether you voted for him or not, he's just all in the news everywhere, every minute.
I'm with you.
Whether you voted for him or not, I have never let politics stop me from loving anybody. Otherwise, I couldn't love half the members of my family. But enough.
I will let you know
right now, honey,
that we are talking to some of the finest women in America right now on the state of things. Marshall Chapman is with me, along with Lee Smith and Jill McCorkle, and they're going to be doing a benefit performance, and we have the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Jill, you're going to be reading, or will now for us, from Dime Store. Are you going to be reading also that evening, Sunday evening?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, can you read a little something for us now? Maybe.
Yes.
Set it up?
Okay. All right. So,
I think a lot of
the reason we play off of each other so well is because, like, what you could see, you know, with Jill and Marshall, it's like turning points in women's lives, and that's what makes a story, and that's what makes a song. You know, it's just when you get hit with something like that. Okay, so this is a little short story. Want me to read this little tiny? It's named Romantic Fever. The house I grew up in was one of a row of houses strung along a narrow river bottom like a string of beads between the mountains. I was in love with my best friend's father, three houses down the road. Mr. Owens had huge, dark, soulful eyes, thick black hair, and the prettiest singing voice available. Every night after supper, he'd sit out in his garden by the river and play his guitar and sing for Martha and me and every other kid in the neighborhood who'd gather round to listen. Mr. Owens played songs like Wayfaring Stranger and the Alabama Waltz. He died the year we were 13 from an illness described to me as romantic fever. Though later I would learn that the first word was actually rheumatic, in my own mind it remained romantic fever. An illness I associated with those long summer evenings when my beloved Mr. Owens played the old sad songs, while lightning bugs rose like stars from the misty weeds along the Black River as night came on. The link between love and death intensified when my MYF group, that's Methodist Youth Fellowship, went to Myrtle Beach, where we encountered many exotic things such as pizza pie, and northern boys smoking cigarettes on the boardwalk. Our youth leader, who was majoring in drama at a church school, threw our cigarettes into the surf and led us back up onto the sandy porch of the boarding house for an emergency lecture on petting. A nice girl, she said dramatically, does not pet. It is cruel to the boy to allow him to pet because he has no control over himself. He is just a boy. It is all up to the girl. If she allows the boy to pet her, then he will become excited. And if he cannot find relief, then the poison will all back up into his organs, causing pain and sometimes death. She spat out the words. We drew back in horror and fascination. Of course, it wasn't long before I found myself in the place where I'd been headed all along. The front seat of a rusty old pickup heading up a mountain on a dark gravel road with a wild older boy. Let's call him Wayne, whom I scarcely knew but had secretly adored for months. This was not the nice boy I'd been dating, the football star student government leader who'd carried my books around from class to class all year and held my hand in study hall. But though he dutifully pressed his body against mine at dances in the gym whenever they played the 12th of Never, our song, it just wasn't happening. That fiery hand did not clasp my vitals as it did in Jane Eyre whenever she encountered Mr. Rochester. So I had seized the chance when Wayne asked me if I'd like to ride around sometime. You bet, I'd said, so fast it startled him. I'd love to. Wayne was a big, slow-talking boy with long black hair that fell down into his handsome, sullen face.
And if you want to hear the rest of this delightful story, you will be at Someday at the Lisa Little Auctions in Hillsboro. Thank the three of you for being on our show today. Lee Smith, Jill McCorkle, Marshall Chapman. That's the name of that song. And we will play us out with a little bit of music that you're going to hear as well. Thanks so much for being
here. Okay, thank you.
That's right. I was working through college.